Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Respiratory. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the management of rare and unusual neuroendocrine tumours, also known as NETs. Specialists in the MDT involved in caring for patients with NETs discuss individual patient cases to highlight new and emerging approaches to diagnosis and treatment, and the impact of effective multidisciplinary teamwork and coordination on patient care. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Advanced Accelerator Applications and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, a medical oncologist, an endocrinologist, and a nuclear medicine specialist discuss the challenges in diagnosing patients with rare and unusual NETs, and the importance of referral to a specialist unit to ensure patients receive the appropriate diagnostic workup for a timely and accurate diagnosis.
Hello. My name is Diane Reedy Lagunas, and I'm a medical oncologist and the Associate Deputy Physician in Chief at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. I'm joined today by my dear colleagues and friends, Dr. Thomas Hope, who's a nuclear medicine physician and director of molecular therapy at UCSF in San Francisco, also in the United States, and Professor Dr. Marianne Pavel, endocrinologist and chair of endocrinology in the Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen in Germany. In this section, we will be considering the question, achieving a timely and accurate diagnosis, how we can have a multidisciplinary input to address our current challenges. So Tom and Marianne, thank you so much for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
I'd like to start to ask the question, what are the challenges associated with the diseases that we care for, particularly because they are so uncommon and they're treated sometimes very differently because of the heterogeneity of the disease? So Tom, as a radiologist, can you share with us a little bit of the challenges from diagnosis to treatment, starting maybe with diagnosis as a radiologist?
Well, I think the problem with neuroendocrine tumors is many of the symptoms overlap with other diseases, right? For example, a small bowel neuroendocrine tumor might present with signs of small bowel obstruction. And so they'll come in through a diagnostic pathway of getting a CT abdomen and pelvis, which will show a small bowel obstruction. But there's nothing really definitive on that imaging study that would characterize something as being a neuroendocrine tumor unless you clearly see a mesenteric mass causing the obstruction. So oftentimes the diagnostic imaging findings are nonspecific. And so the patient's actually diagnosed on pathology inadvertently. And similar things are with other types of metastatic spread of tumor. And so you have these patients who come into the system in essence with nonspecific findings, and you don't in essence get what would be the diagnostic study of choice, which would be a somatostatin receptor PET, where you could actually make that definitive diagnosis. So the problem really is, how do people get here? And when do we think of, when does it come to our mind that we should be trying to diagnose a neuroendocrine tumor? And it's that decision that really drives the imaging choice for how we're going to stage patients.
Absolutely. And Marianne, as Tom said, you know, there's so many different, quote, symptoms that could mimic what a neuroendocrine cancer may present as. At the same time, what's in a name? A lot. And so we lump lots of different diseases called neuroendocrine together. And so a lung NET may certainly present a different way than a pancreatic NET. So anything that you can add in terms of teaching and what the general practitioners or general oncologists that may be working up these folks for the first time may think about or try to understand and think NETs with these different types of diagnoses?
Yeah, then that's indeed true. It's really challenging, the early diagnosis. Either is the path that Tom showed us, that you have a lesion that you then identify being a neuroendocrine tumor. But there are some patients, I think the vast majority, they suffer from symptoms that are rather unspecific. And there may be so many other underlying diseases. You just named the lung NET. Patients may have chronic cough or wheezing, and it takes a long time to really come to the assessment of a neuroendocrine tumor, particularly when on imaging, then a lesion is found. Other patients suffer from abdominal discomfort or diarrhea, and it needs a high index of suspicion to just think of this rare disease, and all the other more common diseases have been ruled out. And At a second step, if imaging has been done, I think the most important is to have an accurate pathology. And that's also a challenge that sometimes lesions are identified, but these lesions are not recognized as a neuroendocrine tumor. And only the pathologist can tell us this is a neuroendocrine lesion. This may be difficult to get an adequate biopsy from a lymph node that is close to the bronchi. And sometimes you need to re-biopsy to have sufficient material. It is much easier from a liver lesion, but it needs a high level of expertise at the pathology level too, because there are many other differential diagnoses. Nowadays, we rarely see that HCC or pancreatic adenocarcinoma is mistaken and later on reclassified as a neuroendocrine neoplasm. I mean, the pathological diagnosis has much improved using immunohistochemical markers, but still the discrimination is sometimes difficult, particularly from other rare endocrine tumors like the paraganglioma. If you have a finding of multiple nodules in the erythropoietoneum and you take a biopsy, then from the HE staining, it may be either a neuroendocrine tumor or a paraganglioma. So they can mimic each other by nested architecture and expression of neuroendocrine markers, but an experienced pathologist will know how to use the additional immunohistochemical tools to make the discrimination between one and the other tumor. I think that's one of the challenges, and I can't go into the details, but maybe too detailed, but it is important to then ask for carotenes or for other markers that are typical for paraganglioma like SOX10 or CDX2 that is very specific for neuroendocrine tumors but is not present in paraganglioma, just to mention some markers.
I think you're absolutely right. So one, our challenges are on the low index of suspicion. And then two, once we do find them, you know, where this cancer starts and what the type of neuroendocrine cancer it is, including a pheoparaganglioma, which can be confusing sometimes as red as a typical neuroendocrine tumor, makes it even more challenging because where it started, as you said, and what type of neuroendocrine it is clearly very important in terms of the right treatment for that patient. So I think in addition to that, as we know, because they're so uncommon, not a lot of patients are actually getting to specialty centers. Tom, can you comment on that a little bit? And in particular, I would say not only is it important to have a physician that understands these diseases, but because there's so many different modalities on what's the right imaging to do, I often have patients getting 15 tests and sometimes 13 of them are the wrong tests. So can you comment on the importance of specialty care? And then, for example, what are the right tests for these different cancers? And in a nutshell, obviously very complicated to answer all in one.
Well, I'll take a stab at that. It's a good question, though. I think the first thing that's hard is, so multidisciplinary care, right? That's where we want to get to. But you don't get to there until you have a diagnosis, right? And so there's this gap between, you know, presentation with symptoms to diagnosis, and then there's a second gap from diagnosis to getting to a center of excellence, in essence, for neuroendocrine tumors. In terms of, you know, going from the diagnosis to a center of excellence, that is a problem. You know, as you know, a lot of patients stay in their local community hospital. It's convenient, it's nearby, their physician who diagnosed them is there, they're comfortable with the facility, you know, and they're not looking to go, you know, travel an hour or two to the nearest center of excellence that might have a multidisciplinary team to take care of neuroendocrine tumors. So I think hopefully part of the take home of this talk is to teach patients that there is value in this. You don't have to go to that center for everything, but going there to get into the system, to have people give feedback on the care you receive is really important. And it also, it not only helps obviously for telling what imaging modalities to use, but also obviously treatments as well, as we'll discuss further on. Now, what imaging modalities should you get? That's very complicated, right? And so I sort of think there's the two main categories, right? There's, you know, molecular imaging, which is predominantly driven by somatostatin receptor PET, although obviously in higher grade tumors, you'd consider FDG PET. And paraganglioma, there's a whole different story of, you know, fluorodopa, which is more available in Europe than it is in the United States, et cetera. And then you also have conventional imaging of CT and MRI, which is going to give you anatomic imaging. So, you know, patients who have liver dominant disease, you'd be considering hepatobiliary phase imaging of the liver, CT scans for small bowel disease, mesenteric disease, nodal disease, particularly lung disease. But that's always very tailored to the individual patient.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And Marianne, I just want to comment on the field paragangliomas, because they are, I sort of call them a cousin of neuroendocrine cancers, and they are so incredibly challenging sometimes to work up and then to treat. Can you share with us some insight on, you know, as a head of endocrinology, you approach those patients?
Yeah, first you have also the clinical suspicion patients may present with hypertensive crisis. They may have chronic arterial hypertension, but sometimes it's episodic, so it's sometimes difficult to identify these patients, but they may have also associated symptoms like sweating and tachycardia. So it's all of these symptoms that that really support this high level of suspicion. And then we can measure metanephrines, normetanephrines in plasma to really biochemically establish the diagnosis. And it also requires a 24-hour recording of the blood pressure. And so you have frequently nightly elevated blood pressure, and all this together then consolidates the diagnosis. And of course, imaging is very important. It's very easy to identify adrenal lesion in a pheochromocytoma. Mostly these tumors are very large and may have necrotic areas in the central part, or calcification, so that for radiologists probably rather easy to identify, but the paraganglioma is much more challenging. And there the PET-CT, and Tom just mentioned it, Doppler PET-CT is frequently used in Germany and for the whole body assessment, and then we can identify the primary lesion and all the metastases, and sometimes this is widespread out. So it's really the clinical suspicion supported by the biochemical assessment, and then this really requires a PET-CT imaging. And I think the PET-CT imaging is really a need, not only for paraganglioma, but also for all types of neuroendocrine tumors as an initial assessment. And since there is lack of access, the patients really need to be referred to a center with expertise. And I think it's not the patient who needs to require for that. I think we need to teach the physicians, and it should be implemented by the healthcare plan that all patients with rare disease at least once in a lifetime need to be at initial diagnosis referred to a center that does all this comprehensive workup. But I also see that in Europe that patients are kept by the local treating physicians. They try to do everything, but then they do an octo scan. I see that patient, he gets operated. I see there's residual disease because it was not detected because of the lower sensitivity of octo scan as compared to PET-CT scan. So it is an extra burden for the patient instead of early referral to a center where all the expertise is there for all the different disciplines. And I think we owe this to our patients, but we need at a political level implement that and transmit this rather to the physician than to the patient, because for the patient it's very difficult to find these centers sometimes and to know where to go and really to get the referral by the primary treating physicians.
Absolutely. So in summary, a multidisciplinary approach for all of these cancers, because they are so challenging, as Dr. Hope said, at least to get a plan. You don't have to stay there, but you do. We owe it to our patients, the patients owe it to themselves, to make sure that the plan that we're following is the right one. So Dr. Thomas Hope, Dr. Marianne Favell, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchrespiratory.com. Don't forget, there are three other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.